Blog Talk Radio.
Clocking at 141
they said the scale was barely even breaking, and he was on there for about like a half a second before they ushered him off really quickly instead of rehydrating him. You look at the pictures of Arturo from that, you could tell he was gone. You could tell he was really dehydrated. So you could, you obviously knew he was having a hard time making the weight. When he got in the ring, he was about 160-something-ish. He had a 19-pound weight advantage over Joey Gamache. Joey Gamache only went up to, like, I think, like 144, and Gotti went up to, like, something like 163. It was something along those lines, and you could tell that he was obviously, he looked two weight classes bigger. And first round, he dropped Gamache, had him hurt. In the second round, I mean, it literally looked like, an adult fighting a teenager. And that's no disrespect to Joey Gamache at all, who was a world-class fighter. You could just tell that the difference in size was significant. And Gotti from there hit him with a combination that was just absolutely brutal. He hit him with an uppercut, and Gamache was out cold from the first punch, and Gotti hit him with two shots as he was on his way down. And Joey Gamache was on the ground for a few minutes, and you could tell he was seriously hurt. And, and he had a lasting injury from that at the end of his career. And I remember hearing much about the lawsuit ever since it happened. He was suing. I think he sued Gotti. I think he sued Gotti's manager, the promoter. And I know there was a severe lawsuit, as we're going to discuss tonight, against the New York State Athletic Commission, because they were the ones that, you know, pretty much allowed, you know, that weigh-in to take place. And a lot of people from the Gamache camp, to this day, obviously, still don't think it was, on the level.
Right. And Keith is actually somebody who fought that case for over 10 years to a verdict that was in favor of Gamache eventually. But that shows you how slow the wheels of justice move. I can attest to that, of course, being my own armchair lawyer, I guess you could call me, even though I was called a professional plaintiff recently at my last hearing. I actually got to get the lawyer up on the stand and everything that that I'm facing, and it was pretty interesting. Even though the hearing was held against me, I kind of used it to my advantage. But, we'll have to touch on that a little bit later, and we'll swap some legal stories with him. And I don't know if he's got a chance to check me out, but I did just get an email from him, so I might shoot over a couple links for him to look at so he's prepared by the time he gets on. But we do have a lot to cover in MMA and boxing. Unfortunately, I probably won't have the time, but the big fight this weekend is going to be Mayorga versus Cotto, and it's here in Vegas. I'm still in Vegas, and it's out here, and I'm going to miss it, I think, but what can you do? There's another big fight coming up that I'm definitely going to try to go to in early April if I'm still here with Michael Katsidis and Robert Guerrero. And I know I said last week that I'm going to try to get an interview with him on video, but I've been so busy this week I haven't even got around to that either. So, make a long story short, we do have some other upcoming bouts. And we have the UFC Live 3 show to talk about. And the main event there was a little bit controversial, although I really didn't see the controversy. Martin Kampman lost a unanimous decision to Diego Sanchez in a fight that they got $160,000 in bonuses each just for that fight, which begs the question that I've brought up time and time again: are these bonuses really fair to some of these other fighters who fight just as hard and don't get them? But anyway, there was also kind of an interesting twist with the Zients situation. And as many of you know who follow me in the show, I have litigation against Zients, and I have a couple inside sources at the company right now who were actually very surprised. They didn't even know that there was a guy who was on the other side of the knockout of the night. Thiago Tavares came in with Zients on his shorts, his white shorts, and nobody at the company even knew. Oh. They sponsored this guy. And maybe they didn't even sponsor him. They just decided to throw these shorts on him. And it was one of those fights that was not featured. Reigns wasn't really featured in the cage as much as usual. So I don't know why, if that was the reason why they did that or what. But Shane Roller knocked Tiago Tavares out with a huge right hand, and just was just probably one of the best knockouts I've seen in a long time in MMA, just because it just came out of nowhere. But also, we had another interesting fight with Brian Bowles and Demetrio Page. It was a rematch that actually ended at the exact same time by the exact same move as their previous fight. Brian Bowles caught Page in a guillotine choke, and it was in the first round at 3 minutes and 30 seconds. So it's just kind of weird that that happened, but that was another product of the WEC merger there. Both guys came over from there. We also had Chris Weidman beat Alessio Sicara. I believe it was Weidman's UFC debut, and Sicara is a veteran, but he lost by unanimous decision. Weidman just tore him apart, and it's kind of a shame they don't have decision of the night. That probably should have been it. But then we had Mark Munoz took out CB Dolloway in the first round by knockout by way of punches. Cyril Diabate beat Steve Cantwell by decision. Danny Castillo beat Joe Stevenson by decision. Takeya Mizugaki beat Ruben Duran by split decision. Dong Gian beat Rob Kibbins by TKO. Usmal Parhares beat Dave Branch by heel hook submission in the second round. And Igor Pokorzhak beat Todd Brown by TKO. So that about wraps up with the Diego Sanchez versus Martin Campman fight. One of the reasons why it, the main event, of course, it also got the fight of the night bonuses and an extra $100,000 from Dana. It was because it was probably one of the bloodiest fights we've seen this year in MMA. And I actually just today saw a clip of Diego talking about it backstage after the fight, and he had a big ice pack on his one eye, and then the other eye, you can see there was a huge gash above it, on almost on the eyelid, and then there was a gash below it. And he was bleeding all over the place, and the other eye was just swollen shut by the end of the fight. And then he had also a cut on the upper part of his chin, right under his bottom lip, that was bleeding through almost the whole third round pretty badly. And he was talking after the fight saying, oh, you know, these are the type of fights that, you know, we talk about when we get old, you know, because it's, everybody always wants to go out there and knock somebody out in the first round, but it's really these fights that we look back on and are most proud of, because it was a real war out there, you know. But it was a brutal war, that's for sure. And Diego got the decision, but he was definitely more beat up in the face area. Campman had one major cut under one of his eyes that kind of opened up more in the third round. And Campman definitely won the first round. The second round was a little iffy as to who really could have been called the winner. Both guys had their moments. And then the third round was definitely Diego. So a lot of people say that Campman got screwed because he won the second round, but yeah, it's one of those subjective standards, you don't know. Dana White thought that Diego Sanchez won, but Randy Couture, who coaches Campman, said that it was definitely his fighter. But, you know, obviously there's some bias there, so who knows who really won. But either way, they both got compensated very well to MMA standards anyway. So it was definitely worth watching. And as far as boxing, did you get to catch any boxing this past weekend?
I did, Rich. Let me go over some of the fights that were on Saturday night. First, the card that I did not get to see, I don't know if it was televised or not. It was from Newark, New Jersey at the Prudential Center. The main event was for the vacant IBF junior welterweight championship. Let me just confirm that. But that was Zab Super Judah. He won the vacant title. He got knocked down. He never had the greatest chin in the world, but he fought a gentleman by the name of Kazir Mazuba. I never had the opportunity to see him fight. I know he has a win over Kendall Holt. And, he does have some losses early in his career. The one fighter that was on Friday Night Fights, Ray Nahr, has a second-round knockout over him. He's been knocked out a few times. So Zab took him out. Now he's again the IBF junior welterweight champion. Zab is 41-6 with 28 knockouts. He is trying to throw himself in the Manny Pacquiao sweepstakes. I think everybody is, to be honest. Also on that card was a former best of ours, Carvis Sims, who won an 8-round decision over John Mackey. Tarvis, 27-1, 11 knockouts. He has one draw on there. It was his second fight after his loss to Alan Green. And Carvis is down a little bit in weight. I mean, he was fighting for a while at super middleweight. His fight with Alan Green was 168. Now he's down to 158, so he's getting himself back down into shape. Tarvis is obviously still a world-class fighter, and he's 39 years old. Yes, he is getting up there in age, but he hasn't had a whole lot of tough fights, so we need a chance to still make some noise. It's a very loaded division, the junior middleweight division. Also, the middleweight division has some good prospects up there. Let's go to the fight card that was on HBO. It was a doubleheader. The two fights that I really would have liked to have seen that were not aired, one was the return of James Kirkland. He's a very impressive junior middleweight prospect. He spent some time away in prison. He hadn't fought in 2 years. His last fight was March 7, 2009. He came back. He fought a guy by the name of Ashanti Gibbs, who was 10-2 coming in. And after a matter of seconds, Ashanti Gibbs became 10-3. Kirkland overwhelmed him, knocked him out. Very exciting fighter, a lot of potential. His thing is he's just got to keep himself clean. I mean, he's 26-0 with 23 knockouts. He's a southpaw with tremendous power. A lot of potential. He's just got to keep himself out of trouble. Also, we had the return of Daniel Jacobs, who was a middleweight prospect. He was really on the high road, moving up quickly, and then he got absolutely destroyed by Dmitry Pirog, who was a relative unknown going into the fight, even though he was 16-0. So now Jacobs was in his second fight back. It's a relatively, easier mark. His name is a guy named, by the name of Robert Kluwer, who was 11-12 coming in, and once again, a first-round knockout. Jacobs is back on the winning track. He is now 22-1 with 19 knockouts, a lot of potential. The thing that fight with Pirog really derailed him. The two fights they showed on that card, we had one fight was between Adrian Broner, who's an up-and-coming prospect, very flashy kid. He's from Cincinnati. He had Aaron Pryor Sr. in his corner. Coming off like he was a real deal. He was 19-0 with 16 knockouts coming in. He's fighting the former champion, Daniel Ponce de Leon, who was 41-2. Werner in the ring before the fight was dancing. He was, looking flashy, but he did not impress me at all. He got the decision. Two of the judges had it close, 96-94, which was acceptable. The third judge had it 99-91, meaning he only gave Ponce de Leon one round. And that was just not acceptable. I know a lot of arguments that Ponce de Leon won that fight. Now, going to the main event, which was a fight that actually went 8 rounds longer than I expected it, was Saul Alvarez versus Matthew Hatton. Saul Alvarez, I don't think, lost a minute of that fight. dominated Hatton over the entire 12 rounds. I am just surprised that it went the 12 rounds, to be totally honest. You know, he dominated the fight. He outworked Hatton. He had him hurt a couple times. But Hatton, he's a tough fighter. He doesn't have his brother's tenacity. He doesn't have his brother's punching power. So basically, I mean, he's... I was watching the fight, and it was funny. Matthew Hatton's taking, you know, some lumps. He, unlike Ricky, Matthew Hatton has a shaved head. I mean, he has no facial hair. So he's just completely smooth, you know, bald head, pale white skin. And it reminded me of that movie, because it was on TV last year, that movie Powder, that came out in, like, the mid-90s about the bald albino kid.
Yeah.
I'm like, that looks like Matthew Hatton. I was waiting for him to get struck by lightning. It looked just like him. It was bald albino. But yeah, Alvarez dominated that fight, won pretty handily over the 12 rounds. And now he claims the vacant WBC junior middleweight title. And there's a war of words going on between a fellow Mexican, Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. And, boy, I could see that being a very interesting affair. Alvarez is kind of easy to hit. You know, Chavez Jr. obviously has a pedigree. Alvarez has been fighting since he was 15 years old. And, you figure he's not even 21 yet. He'll be 21 in July. And he's already 36-0 with 26 knockouts. Yeah, I'm looking, because we got a couple big fights coming up this weekend. I know you talked about the Cota Mayorga fight. Don King is actually picking Mayorga.
Really?
Yeah, but I think you know why, though, right?
Yeah, that's his fight.
That's who he promotes. He's come out there, he's picking Mayorga. He's figuring he wants to get Mayorga. He wants to get him a fight with the Golden Goose by the name of Manny Pacquiao. And he figures if they can knock off Cota, that's the step in the right direction. But looking at the schedule this weekend, I know we have two major fight cards. One's going to be on Showtime pay-per-view. That was the bout between Cotto and Mayorga. On the undercard, we got Powell Wolak fighting Yuri Foreman. Yuri Foreman coming off his knee injury last year in his fight with Cotto at Yankee Stadium. Wolak is 28-1 with 18 knockouts. Foreman's 21-1 with 8 knockouts. So the power obviously is never in Foreman's, and never in his corner. It's unlike George Foreman. Then also we have a interesting fight card from Connecticut. Gio Martinez. Fresh off his destructive knockout win over Paul Williams a few months ago. He's back in the ring to defend the Ring Magazine and also WBC middleweight title, but we'll put more stock in the Ring Magazine title. So, actually, this is the WBC Diamond middleweight title, which I really don't know what that means. So we have Sergio Martinez, who's 46-2 with 25 knockouts. And he is fighting Sergey Dereznyuk, who is 37-0 with 23 knockouts. And that actually should be a very interesting fight.
Yeah, definitely. Another fight you might not be aware of. Victor Camacho Jr. is fighting tomorrow night.
Oh, and I was glad I wasn't aware of it. Thank you.
He's 53-4 with 1 draw, 28 knockouts. He's fighting Juan De La Rosa, who's 20-3 with 15 knockouts, 1 draw, and it's for the vacant IBF Latino light middleweight title.
Well, at least they're both Latinos. Is that, let me look at, what day is that fight, Rich?
That's tomorrow night, Friday.
Friday, okay, let me look at the Friday record. Because I'm thinking that's the same Juan De La Rosa that was on the 1 year of the contender.
Maybe. 20-3. Also, Zahir Rahim at light welterweight is fighting Esteban Almarez. Raheem is 31-3 with 18 knockouts. Almarez is 10-3 with 4 knockouts. That's for the vacant USBA Southern Region light welterweight title.
Rich, I did some quick looking up. Yes, that is the same Juan De La Rosa that was on the contender. In 2004, he had the first win over Tariq Salmachi, and then he had a win over Jesse Uta. Those were both, contender fight. The first fight was in the contender, and I remember that he broke his hand or something, where he got a small cut, and he pulled out of the fight. He pulled out of the contender series, took a little bit of criticism, and then the fight with Jesse Uta was a year later, and if I'm not mistaken, that may have been when they were having, like, contender versus, like, a contender something or other. Like, a lot of the guys are fighting, and whoever De La Rosa's opponent was pulled out, and they put this guy in there. That's why I didn't recognize his name. But yeah, Juan De La Rosa was a contender. Hector Camacho Jr., 53-4, but he's just coming off, one round.
Say that again?
Getting lost here for a second. He's coming off a devastating first round knockout to David Lemieux back in October. He had a fight a few weeks ago against Juan Astorga, won a unanimous decision. But, I mean, that fight against David Lemieux, I showed the fight on YouTube to my dad. I mean, he got knocked out cold, one punch.
Wow. Pretty crazy. Well, we also have another fight in Vegas that I'm not going to make it to. The so-called main events aren't that great, but there is a fight on there. Couple fights that are pretty interesting. So at heavyweight, we have Ty Fields, 45-2 with 41 knockouts, fighting Michael Grant, 46-4 with 34 knockouts. And also light welterweight, Joel Casamayor, 37-5 with 1 draw, 22 knockouts, fighting Emmanuel Lima, 18-1 with 10 knockouts. And I just published a blog on this from a press release about how this is a make-or-break fight for Casamayor, who's obviously been around.
Yeah, I mean, he was an Olympian for Cuba. I mean, I think I was still about maybe 14 years old. But back to the main event there between Michael Grant and Ty Fields, it's got to be one of the few times Michael Grant is having the height disadvantage. He's 6'7". Fields is about 6'9". They both weigh in the 250 pounds. I think Fields is actually closer to maybe 270. I know Grant's in the 250 range. I mean, they're two very, very big guys. Now, here's the thing is, I mean, Grant was obviously the better pedigree fighter. You know, back in 2000, he fought Lennox Lewis for the undisputed heavyweight championship of the world. Ring Magazine was actually picking Grant to win. Didn't work out that way. I mean, Lewis really bombarded him, knocked him out in two rounds. Grant, tremendous athlete. I mean, he could have been a professional baseball player. He could have been a professional football player. Obviously, he could have been a professional basketball player. You know, he was a letter winner in all those sports back when he was in school. Just a tremendous athlete, but his two main weaknesses as a fighter was, one, did not have a great chin. You can't teach a great chin. And the other one is they said he's just too nice of a guy. He did not have a fighter's killer instinct. I mean, I actually saw him, fight in person about maybe two or three times. And I remember the one fight that was down at the Philadelphia Spectrum. And he was fighting a guy that he could have taken out. And it looked like about like a round. And he was just, looked like he was carrying him. Then around the fifth round, he finally opened up and he stopped the guy. But it's like, you know, he just never look like he could put it all together. And it's a shame because, I mean, he's one of the nicest guys in the sport. You just were hoping that he could have, you know, really, you know, been a great, American star. He had all the physical attributes to do it. Ty Fields, on the other hand, once again, a very nice guy. He's not a natural athlete. He's a big guy. He's won some fights because, you know, he's a big guy. But in one of his last fights, about I guess it was about 2 or so years ago, he got completely bombarded by the guy's name that bombarded him. But it was like 42 seconds over, and he's like out cold. And so it's like, literally, this fight is going to be a battle between the behemoths with no chin between them.
Well, before we get Keith Sullivan on the phone, we're going to continue these matchups later. There's a few more I want to mention in boxing, but I just want to do the mismatch of the week. Comes from Ghana tomorrow night. Ghana, we have a super featherweight main event between Maxwell Awuku, who's 21-2 with one draw, 12 knockouts, fighting Zakaria Salifu, who is 1-5.
Nice.
No title, thank God, on the line. But let's try to get our litigation friend here on the phone, Keith Sullivan.
And after we talk to him, remind me about an article I want you to get posted on the site.
Okay.
Just remind me, and then we'll talk about it.
If I could get this thing to show up. All right, there we go.
Oh, Rich, by the way, while you're looking at that, you know what this week was?
What?
The 40th anniversary of Rocky.
Rocky fight? I don't know.
No, Rocky, like the 76. That was my birth.
First thing I
could
have taken.
No, man, it was the 40th anniversary of the first Ali Frazier fight.
Ooh.
At the tone, please record your message.
All right. We had a little issue there. Hello?
Hello?
You there? Keith isn't there.
I thought I heard a voicemail.
Yeah, it was a voicemail. About to ask him how much is he charging for this.
Hello?
Hey, Keith, this is Rabble Rousing Rich.
Hey, Rich, how you doing?
Good. We also have our big boxing expert on the line, Tony the Tornado.
How you doing? It's Tony, right?
Hey, how's it going, man?
How are you guys?
Oh, doing good.
Are we on the air?
We are live on the air.
All right.
Now,
I'm in New York City at an event for the American Ireland Fund, and Teddy Atlas is here with me, and he's upstairs. I just snuck out so I could talk with you folks. And John Betty from, where is he from? Derry, Ireland. He's up there. He's receiving some Irish Spirit Award, even though he's just announced his retirement from the lovely sport of boxing.
Jeez, with a name like Sullivan, I never would have guessed you were Irish. No, but actually, I'm half Irish, too. Other side of the family was Hartley. So,
let me ask you, who do you guys like this weekend? Andy Lee, Frank McEwen.
Oh, geez, I haven't really looked at it that much, but Andy Lee.
Come on, Andy Lee's my guy. I represent Andy Lee. This is a big step up in competition for him.
I got to go with Andy Lee. One of his fights about a year or so ago, he has a stoppage win over a former sparring partner of mine, Willie Gibbs. So, I mean, and I knew Willie very well. So if Andy could beat a guy like Willie, you know that he's a top-tier fighter.
Nice. All right. That's what I like to hear. He had a tremendous knockout in the Garden a couple of years ago, about 4 or 5 years ago now, forgetting who. I was a former world champion. The name will come to me. But he has a deadly left hook when he throws it. So hopefully he's fighting a kid from Scotland whom he beat in the amateurs. But he's now 19-0, he's signed by Golden Boy, and he's trained by Freddie Roach. So it's by no means a walkthrough for Andy. It's going to be a nice, I think for once, the sport of boxing, the landscape of boxing, is going to see a real good, evenly matched fight. And hopefully, if everybody tunes in on HBO, they'll get their money's worth, so to speak.
Yeah, I'm looking. I just pulled up my box rec record here because I'm on the computer right now. We got Andy Lee is 24-1, 18 knockouts. The fighter he's going against is Craig McEwen, who was 19-0 with 10 knockouts. You know, you're right. It's definitely two up and comers out there. It's a good fight that you don't get to see very often between two young prospects.
And two young prospects that are trained by legendary trainers. Andy Lee has Emmanuel Stewart, who very unfortunately will not be in his corner this weekend, obviously because he's got to be out in Vegas with you guys for Miguel Cotto's fight. So that's unfortunate. And also McEwen beat Ryan Zero, who is Andy Lee's only loss. So it's this fight has been making, I think. It sort of slipped under a lot of people's radar screen. We just signed Andy Lee with Cabela Entertainment, who is co-promoting the fight with Golden Boy. And we just got that deal wrapped up about 2 weeks ago. So they've sort of been on a last-minute promotional tour. But I think it's going to be a tremendously exciting fight for the fans.
Two softballs I see, too, right?
Yeah, McEwen actually fights orthodox, but he switches to southpaw. But when he fires away, when he stands in the pocket and he's doing most of his work, he's fighting orthodox. Most times when he switches to southpaw, it's really just to throw off the opponent, give him a different look and then change things up. But when he wants to start doing his damage, he always goes right back to orthodox.
Gotcha.
Okay, I'm going to put aside your promoter's hat there for a second, and let's talk about the litigation that you've done. We kind of introduced it a little bit, the Joey Gamache case, but something that took
sure.
2 years to get a verdict. Tell us what that was like, and how hard that case was.
The Joey Gamache case was a real tough case for me. Not only from an evidentiary standpoint, legally. But emotionally, too, because Joey, and if you guys have known him and have had the chance to meet him and follow him all during his career, I mean, he's a two-time welterweight world champion, and he's just probably one of the nicest guys you can ever meet and a real throwback in the sport, a real, real throwback old-school mentality guy. Everything with him was always done on a handshake. Hell, I'm an attorney, and I didn't even have a retainer with him. I didn't even have a signed contract with him. That's how much we trusted each other, and that's the way he wanted it. Everything was on our word. So it was a tough case. What we were up against was a very political fight. The governor of New York State at that time had basically never took the athletic commission as a serious post, and he appointed political hacks, people that made large contributions. One guy was a friend of a friend. He wrote a letter to get on the commission. Sure, you can go right in there. You're a sports fanatic. Fine. That guy ends up making his way up to be the actual chairman of the commission. It was a real, real disaster for New York around that time, around 2000. And what happened with Joey's case is that on the day of the weigh-in, Joey got on the scale and he weighed in. Trust me, he was underweight. And everybody was concerned, saying, we just weighed in yesterday, we weighed in this morning, we were right on weight, why are you 3-4 pounds underweight? They suspected that something had been messed around with the scale. They asked that the Department of Weights and Measures comes down and redoes the scale. So at the very last minute, a new scale was brought in, it was recalibrated, and the weigh-in went forward. Well, lo and behold, Arturo Gatti gets on the scale, and if you've ever seen the videotape of Arturo Gatti getting on the scale for that fight, I have never seen fear in Arturo Gatti's eyes, and I follow him religiously, all of his fights. Let me tell you, he had fear when he stepped on the scale that night. And it's always been our belief that he knew where it had gotten out, that they were using a legitimate scale, and that he was going to come in heavy. And during the course of the trial, I called a witness who worked in Gotti's corner, is one of his seconds, and he admitted that that day, he still had some weight to lose, and they went to Bally's here in New York City, put on the plastic suit, sat in the sauna, got on the treadmill, and they spent 2 or 3 hours in the gym dropping those extra pounds, walked over to Madison Square Garden wearing the plastic suit. Guys, they never would have taken those measures if Arturo was anywhere close to weight or on weight. And when he gets on the scale, it's set for 141 pounds, the contract weight. And in the video, you can see the deputy commissioner move the scale to a heavier, it was a balance beam scale without the digital recording. So he touches it and he moves it to a heavier level. How many pounds could he move it? You know, from the video, it wasn't a tremendous amount. It really only looked like maybe 2 or 3 pounds. And then he instructed Arturo to raise his hands. And as he did, if you've ever stood on the balance beams, you'll know that the scale begins to bounce up and down. And as it was bouncing, he calls out his weight as 141 pounds. And Arturo turns to step off the scale. The legendary Johnny Boz, who was Joey's manager at the time, puts his arm up and sort of stiff-arms Gotti to make him stay on the scale. Gotti turns his face back and he looks at the deputy commissioner with outright fear in his eye, like, please, don't make me lose another pound here. And with that, Gotti's trainer starts yelling at him to get off the scale. He jumps off the scale. They hand him a bottle of water. He starts chugging the water right away. The Gamache can't make a fuss. Everybody there, the reporters are going crazy. And the commission says, no, 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 no. And he actually says to the Gamache camp, shut the F up and stop stirring up X. And you know what those words stand for. I don't know what the FCC regulations are and what I can say and not say here, so I'll be a gentleman about it.
We're a friendly show, so go for it.
All right. They basically told the Gamache camp, shut the fuck up and stop stirring up shit. And Jimmy Glenn, who's a legendary trainer, who's a man of utmost integrity, said, I don't care what you think. Get the man back on the scale. And they said, look, we can't. He's drinking water. And Jimmy said to them, I'll give him a pound. Just let me see that the guy can make 142 pounds, a pound over the weight limit. And with that, the Gotti camp quickly whipped Gotti right out of the room, and that was that. And then Joey got on the stand. He weighed in at, I think, about 40. The next day, at the unofficial weigh-in by CPO, Arturo had ballooned 15% increase, and he had put on 19 pounds. You see that happen in larger weight divisions, but it's the body mass percentage that's really shocking to the conscience there, 16%. Everybody that was there that night said it was tough to watch because you were looking at two guys that were just clearly in weight divisions separated by 2 or 3 divisions. And Arturo Gotti, as you know, beat the hell out of Joey Gamache, and he never fought again. So the case finally came to trial about 10 years later, and we were able to prove that, indeed, the New York State Athletic Commission was negligent, that they failed to carry out their duties that day, and that, in fact, they had not properly weighed in Arturo Gotti, and further than that, that they had intentionally circumvented their legal mandate and responsibility to carry out proper weigh-ins. And that was a tremendous, tremendous victory. Unfortunately for Joey, it ended there. The judge said as far as the physical and emotional damage he sustained as a result, he was in, he suffered a concussion, he was in the hospital for 2 days and untold medical problems since then. The judge, and trying to be objective, maybe he's right, the judge said, for a guy who's had this career, who's had the amateur pedigree that he has, he was on the Olympic trial teams, then he had 50-something, 50-4 was his final professional record, two-time world champion. You can't prove that the damage he has today is a result of that particular fight. So he said that the commission was at fault, that they were negligent, but that he would not award money damages to Joey Gamache. So that's where the story ends. But it's a great decision that really sends a clear message to not just the New York State Athletic Commission, to every commission in the country, that they have got to be on their game and they've got to take care of these fighters and they've got to make sure that the health and safety of the fighters is primary and of their, one of the first concerns that they have. So, you know, we're very pleased that Joey was able to leave a mark of on the sport of boxing, at least here in New York, and I think across the country, that, you know, these are not to be political hack positions for people who don't know the sport, who don't care about the sport. You know, that's something that Joey is, he left a legacy, and that's something he's very, very proud of.
Cool. And did he have any other defendants that he was able to get any money judgment against at all?
No. When I came into the case, it was, it was probably 5 years after the fact. Joey had come to me after going through two other lawyers, and I took the case on basically on a pro bono basis. And we had filed a federal lawsuit against Golden Boy, who was the promoter of the fight, and Porto Gotti. Unfortunately, those cases were dismissed because the trying to think back to the grounds for that. They had no enforcement regulation of the contract. That was really on the commission to enforce this contract that each fighter weighed 141 pounds. So, you know, the courts just dismissed those cases outright. And the interesting thing is that I had served the subpoena on Arturo Gatti to have him testify, and he was murdered, and we'll get to that in a minute because he was murdered, on Sunday, and the trial was to open up on Monday. So I got a panic call from the assistant state attorney who was handling the case, and he said, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "Look, Judge, we got to go forward. I mean, I think everyone, you know, delaying the trial isn't going to help." So we it was tragic what happened to Arturo, and immediately after the case ended, I worked very closely, also pro bono, with Arturo Gatti's manager to do an investigation in Brazil to ensure that Amanda, his wife, was brought to justice. Unfortunately for, I'll just say, personality conflicts, I've opted to step back from that, and I'm no longer working with those guys, and unfortunately, not much is being done on that end. But for a while there, I went out to Florida. I interviewed some witnesses. I listened to some audio tapes of Arturo. And there's no doubt in my mind that he was absolutely murdered. We had the body exhumed, and it was examined by a forensic pathologist. But, you know, when it became public, a lot of people jumped on the bandwagon, and a lot of people wanted to get their hands in it and start doing the media thing. And I just felt people were getting involved for the wrong reasons. And it wasn't the reason I got involved, but I just said, I'm going to step out of this one, and so I have.
Wow. Dealt with a lot of controversy.
Yeah. What would boxing be without a little controversy, right?
Very, very true. In fact, I've been doing this show with Rich for over 3 years now, and one of the first things I ever brought up, and I'm going back to 2008 when I first started doing the show. Let me say, before you got on the air with us tonight, and it's funny how what you were saying about the Gotti-Gamache fight almost exactly mirrored the way I remembered it. I remember, you know, the fight obviously being signed, and that night I was at an amateur tournament for my alma mater. They were having their annual boxing show, so I said, you know what, HBO does the replay the next day, I'm going to avoid the internet so I can check out the fight. And the first thing, when they both got in the ring, they were showing like little clips of the weigh-in, and from a guy that, you know, knows what it's like to struggle to make weight, the first thing I said when they showed a clip of the weigh-in, I said, man, Gotti looked really gaunt. He really looked gaunt, like his, you know, his eyes were sucked in, his, you know, you could just tell, like, all the fluid had been sucked out of his body. And believe me, I'm a guy that knows what that was like, so I knew the feeling. And I knew the lack of strength that you have from that. When they got in the ring, and I actually said this tonight on the air with Rich when we were doing a preview before we got you on the air with us, I said, it reminded me of a full-grown adult and a teenager in the same ring. It looked like a man and a 13-year-old boy with a difference in their size. They said those were not two guys that weighed in almost exactly the same. I said it looked like a full-fledged middleweight versus a junior welterweight. And that was, I think, the sentiments that pretty much everybody that saw that fight said the same thing. You could just tell the difference in weight, the difference in strength, the difference in physicality. And you knew something was not on the up and up there. But going into – here's another case that you might be familiar with, and this has stuck with me since the mid-'90s. Are you familiar with the murder case against Tim Doc Anderson when he murdered Rick Elvis Parker back in 1995?
Yeah, I'm somewhat familiar with it. If you asked me to sit down and recite all the facts, I'd struggle with that. But I do have a vague familiarity with it.
That was the one where Rick Elvis Parker, as he was called, was well-known in the fight fixing, into the drug scene, and he was promoting Mark Gastineau at the time, and he wanted to set up a dream fight with Mark Gastineau against George Foreman. This was back in the early 90s, and everybody that's anybody knows that George Foreman would have murdered Mark Gastineau. I mean, he seriously would have hurt the man, but Rick Parker didn't care about that. Rick Parker cared about making the money, so he wanted to set up a fight with the guy that Foreman had beaten, Tim Anderson. And then he wanted Anderson to take a dive, say that Gastineau was a better fighter than Foreman, and then cash in on a multi-million-dollar payday. Anderson said yes, and then reneged and beat the shit out of the guy. They had a rematch. Anderson was drugged. That was proven by doctors. And when he tried to find out what he was drugged with so he could, get better and resume his life, because Parker didn't care about him. You know, they left the guy on the floor of an arena. You know, they didn't care. When he went to find out, Parker started threatening death threats against Anderson and his family, and Anderson shot him and killed him, and is now serving a mandatory life sentence in a Florida prison, for what really should be self-defense.
Now, has he exhausted all of his appeals? I thought he had at least one. But I never really heard much after that.
Yeah, I had it was big news back in the mid 90s, around 95 when it happened. And I remember Ring Magazine writing a very extensive article back in 97, 98, because I was still in college when I read it, and it just affected me that much. And a few years ago when I still first started getting on the show with Rich, I said, Rich, I want to discuss this on the air just in case any of our listeners, you never know who can hear it. And, the right person hears about this, and you just never know by bringing it up. And I really did some research on it. I pulled some internet articles, and I still have them somewhere, just reading all the facts of the case and how really disturbing it was. And it's such a shame. It's such a shame that a guy that was just trying to make an honest living and, be a fighter because he enjoyed doing it, was set up and then eventually had his life ruined by a guy that was nothing more than a life-sucking leech. And then this guy tried to defend himself, an innocent person's in jail for trying to defend his life of himself and his family.
Yeah, it's just another tragedy of one of the many fighters in the sport who gets taken advantage of by the less than scrupulous people that are in the sport with them. It's a real shame. But I lost track of that case some years back. I mean, like you said, it was the Ring Magazine. I thought the case had some more of a national platform and just outside. I thought it reached the media beyond the boxing world. And I heard stories about an appeal that was being filed. And that was it. It sort of went away, and I never really heard much about it since. So you just brought it up.
Something that we talked about a lot, and it's kind of like one of those examples from my experience of being my own attorney in a couple different cases. It's something that I've seen time and time again, that the wheels of justice move slow as it is, but once you try to put it in reverse, they go even slower, I think. I don't know if you've seen that.
You're fighting a few of your own good fights there, Rich, right?
Yeah. I got the Fertitta family as counter-defendants in one of my cases, so I know what politics is like. I'm out here in Vegas for that right now. I just had a couple of hearings in the last couple of months. And one of the other cases I'm working on, there was a judge who was just so biased, it was incredible. She was, the doctor sued a former patient who he had injured, and she was complaining online about it. And I was writing a book about this woman. And the judge was on the board of directors for the healthcare company that the doctor paid his practice insurance to and his facility rent to. And she wouldn't step down. And I took the case all the way to the Seventh Circuit and tried to get a writ of mandamus. And the Seventh Circuit actually just ruled a few days ago that I'm not going to get my relief. But the ruling was like, well, you know, it had some merit, and these are the cases that it goes along. But the judge is done with the case, so there's nothing we can do. So I was just left sitting there like, give me a break, you know. So you're saying because you guys are too slow, I lose.
Yeah, I tell you, Rich, I tell my clients all the time, if you're looking for justice, keep walking past the courthouse, because often, more often than not, you're not going to find it inside those walls.
Yeah. And it's just so often these judges, number one, they don't ever like to see a person representing themselves. It seems like they really would love to see the system get fed, even if somebody
sure.
Is good at it. And then the other thing is, you know, it's all about the home state in so many cases. If you're coming from out of state, forget about it. Whether you have it or not, you know, protect their home party.
You don't stand a chance. Isn't that a disgrace? And you see it so clearly from the bench so many times. I mean, I teach at a law school, and I tell these students as they graduate, man, you're going to see and feel bias from the bench like you've never seen before in life. And it's a part of our business that we're trying to hopefully weed out and move past. But it is so blatant in our line of business, man. It's really frustrating.
Yeah, that's why I was really happy that my latest case in Massachusetts involving the same parties as the one in Indianapolis, the lawyer was actually just probably the absolutely worst lawyer I've ever seen. I mean, he files this case based on absolute junk. And anyway, he asked for a jury trial, which surprised me because, you know, I don't think he could relate to anybody, not even a judge, but a jury. So it's going to be my first jury trial representing myself, and I can't wait, you know, because there's a woman who killed herself that's at the heart of the story, and I'm on her side of things, so.
Yeah. Hey, Rich, if you ever need anything, you got my contact info. Feel free to give me a call. We can bounce things off back and forth, you know?
Yeah, definitely. But getting back to boxing, what other boxing-related cases have you dealt with over the years?
A lot that never went public that I can't really discuss because, as you know, boxing, a lot gets done behind closed doors. Very recently, Andy Lee got him signed. I represent him. Do some work with Matt Remillard, who's a featherweight. He's got a big fight coming up, real tough fight, March 26th in Atlantic City against, we just got him signed with Top Rank. He's going up against, I believe he's a Golden Boy promoted fighter, Mikey Garcia. Matt is the NABF, North American Boxing Federation champ right now, the featherweight division, and real tough puncher, real, real strong kid. Great prospect, but Top Rank signed him and is throwing him right in there with some real tough competition. I was a little surprised, a little taken back, but you know, he'll have to prove how he is in the ring and see where it goes.
Yes,
and I do a lot of work with Teddy Atlas and his Dr. Atlas Foundation. It's a charity foundation based in New York, but we help causes all throughout the country. And I'm also the legal counsel to the Boxing Writers Association of America, and we're actually having our annual dinner in May in Vegas, the night before the Pacquiao fight on that Friday night at the MGM. So, you know, that's real exciting to put an event on out there in Vegas, and we're going to be out there for the week, myself and the other guys on the dinner committee. And, you know, that's a nice organization to be a part of. It's sort of the Oscars of the sport, as you guys know. And Sergio Martinez is Fighter of the Year this year, so that's kind of interesting. The past 2 years, we had Manny Pacquiao, and that just created such a media buzz and a firestorm around his presence at the function. So, and I'll give you a little tidbit. I learned today that Manny is going to try to make an appearance at the dinner the night before, even though he's fighting the next day, because Freddie Roach is receiving Trainer of the Year award, and he'd like to be there to honor Freddie when he receives his award. So, you guys are out there in Vegas, buy your tickets. Manny's supposedly going to make a quick appearance.
Cool. Yeah, I'd love to go to that if I'm still out here. I don't know, but could be the way it's going. I definitely appreciate their work. I know that there was a controversial issue last time we really, I think, talked about the Boxing Writers Association. There was an issue with a guy named Eddie Goldman, who does mostly no-holds-barred MMA fighting type of reporting, but he was actually banned from the Boxing Writers Association at one point because he was telling people how to watch fights for free online. I don't know if you heard that story.
Yep. I was certainly involved in that. And look, we don't condone that anyone breaks any laws. And you can make an argument that maybe it wasn't breaking the law because maybe these laws haven't been challenged in court as to whether or not they apply to the internet or not. But at the end of the day, it's taking what would have otherwise been revenue in the pockets of the promoters. And certainly if we cut them out of the equation, I think there goes the sport. So we're having enough problems as it is. And the BWAA voted on it. They have a board that reviews that stuff. And my recollection is I think they gave him a one-year suspension from the organization, and I don't believe he ever reapplied for membership after that suspension was up. I could be mistaken about that, but I believe that was the outcome. But certainly there were strong feelings on both sides of that equation. And, while I empathize with both parties, I think everyone sort of, the sense was that it didn't feel right, at least, at the very least, whether it would withstand legal scrutiny or not, that's another test. But I always say that I don't think we should base our morals upon what's legal or not legal. We should do what's right. And so the board voted, and I'm not a part of that board. I don't know what the vote count was or what the discussion was. I was just privy to it after the fact. So,
right.
It's unfortunate.
What are the actual requirements to join the association? I mean, I never thought of doing it myself, except for maybe when I first came across it, but I just never did. But
you should look into it. It's on the website, www.bwaa.org. You have to submit, I think, three of your writing samples, and I think everybody starts out as an auxiliary member, and I forget if that's a year or 2 years, and then from there you get elevated to full member where you have voting rights and you can run for office. I am not a member myself. I'm not even an auxiliary member. I'm just their outside pro bono counsel. Jack Hirsch, who writes for Boxing News over in Europe, is the president. He's been the president, I think, now for 3 years. And he's been doing a great job. You know, the BWAA, many, many years ago, and back when, you know, we were talking about some of these other events, the Gamache case in 2000, the murder case in Florida in 95, in the early 90s, the BWAA was a very prominent, influential organization. And it sort of lost that luster and that appeal. And that's something that Jack Hirsch is really bringing back to the organization. These events that he's put on the past 2 or 3 years, the dinners, have been fantastic. And he really does a lot for the writers in creating a better relationship with the promoters, making sure that they have the access that they need to the fighters pre-fight and post-fight. Just simple things about making sure that there's enough seats for all the writers at the various events, getting writers the recognition that they deserve on a big stage platform. to really become, it's coming back to that special organization. Will it ever be as big as it was when boxing was in its heyday? You know, probably not. I don't think anything about the sport will ever maybe get back there unless something unforeseen takes place. But he's really doing a phenomenal job.
Unless Mike Tyson stops playing with pigeons.
I didn't catch that on the Animal Planet. I meant to. I missed it. Growing up, he was my hero. And I'm not ashamed to say that, although maybe a little bit embarrassed. But, you know, life has taken him through many twists and turns. And love him or hate him, he was a phenomenal fighter, a ferocious fighter. And my good friend upstairs, Teddy Atlas, trained him through his amateur years. And then I think Rooney took over after that. But, you know, hey, he certainly drew a lot of fans to the sport, much in the way that Manny Pacquiao is doing now. You know, both guys had that crossover mainstream appeal.
Right.
With regards to Mike Tyson, and like I said, I think no boxing fan that considers himself a true boxing fan, especially of the 80s, can sit there and say that a Mike Tyson fight did not excite them. And I was still growing up during that time, and, you know, I was, you know, I used to watch a lot of boxing as a kid. You know, I'm a Philadelphia guy. So, of course, Philadelphia being a hotbed of boxing, I used to watch a lot of fights, you know, with my dad, you know, fights on CBS, and a lot of good Philadelphia fighters were always on there. This was past the time of Smokin' Joe Frazier, but it was still the time of Matthew Saad Muhammad and the Fletcher brothers, who actually I got to train with one of, the youngest one, Troy. But it was a lot of, you know, good fighters on TV, and you still had your Haglers, your Leonard, your Hearns, your Durans. So, you know, I was getting into fights, but, you know, I was growing up, and, you know, I wanted to concentrate more into professional wrestling. I was a kid, you know, Vince McMahon and Hulk Hogan were larger than life. And I wouldn't watch boxing anymore with my dad for a couple years, maybe for about 4 or 5 years I wouldn't watch it with him. And I don't want to watch boxing. It's boring. I want to watch wrestling with a dad. You're watching that. You know, you're watching that again, right? You know what I mean? You know, he's making fun of me. But then Tyson started fighting. I was like, you know, and then I felt like I was like a kid, you know, sneaking to watch, like, dirty movies. If nobody be around, I'd sneak a Mike Tyson tape in and watch that. And but then I'd take it out and rewind it real fast, and nobody knew I was watching it. You know, because I didn't want my dad to see, you know, that he was right, and, you know, that I would be a boxing fan when I saw this guy. And I'll never forget the fight with Burbick when, you know, he knocked him down with three punches, with three times with one left hook. And, but the one... The one that stands out more to me than anything was the fight against Larry Holmes. And we were at a dinner that night, and, you know, a bunch of my dad's friends were there, and I was like, I was the youngest one there. I was like, you know, 11 or 12 years old. And, you know, my dad there and a bunch of his adult friends, and the one kid that was with us, he was about 4 or 5 years older than me. He was about 16. And they were all talking about this fight. Oh, man, what do you think Tyson's going to do to Holmes tonight? And they're sitting there talking. And next thing I know, I'm trying to fit in. So I'm sitting there, I'm like, oh, yeah. And as I'm talking, my dad looks at me like, what are you talking about? I'm like, I can't wait to go home and watch it. So like, oh, you're watching the fight tonight? I'm like, yeah, I'm watching the Tyson fight tonight. and, you know, and then I was at home, and I was, you know, watching. I was getting all excited. And it's like, oh, it's funny, you didn't like this. I'm like, but it's Tyson. And the one thing I'll say about Mike Tyson, which I still find cool to this day, that Mike Tyson would take a tune-up fight with the number one contender. And the one I remember is that, you know, he knocked out Holmes in January, and he's going to fight Spinks in June, and it's like, oh, wait, you got a mandatory defense against Tony Tubbs. You got to fight him. Yeah, just squeeze it in March. I'll take him on. I mean, you don't see that anymore. You don't see, you know, undisputed heavyweight champion of the world taking a tune-up defense with the number one contender. Like, yeah, I'm having a mega fight. Just squeeze in the mandatory guy. I'll take him out. And he did, and that was the cool part about it.
Yeah, he was a true warrior. He was an absolute true warrior. Hey, fellas, I'm getting a two-minute warning. I'm at this function here, and I've got to give out an award. I thought it was at 9:30, but they're waving me in saying 2 or 3 minutes, we need you back inside. So, unfortunately, I've got a couple of minutes before we can keep chatting, but then I'm going to have to hop.
Okay? Missed. But yeah, that's kind of interesting. You brought up Mike Tyson because he had the there was a story in the paper out here the other day. They had a protest outside of his house, and there was actually kind of a fight between the two people being interviewed. One was a PETA organizer, and the other was the pigeon control guy for Vegas. And he was saying, "Well, you know, you guys shouldn't be protesting Mike Tyson. You should be protesting me because we shoot pigeons."
Yeah, you speak about heavyweights. I've been keeping my eyes on Alexander Povetkin. You know, not only does my friend Teddy train him, I got to be objective about that, but he's one of these—he's from Russia, and he doesn't have that typical Russian European style. He's a little bit slicker, and he's much smaller than most of the other heavyweights out there. I'm hearing that there may be a title fight lined up for him come this summer. We'll see. I know he's got to get at least one other fight in there beforehand, but that I think he's an exciting guy to watch on the heavyweight scene. I think Klitschko's great. I like the person. You know, I like him as a person individually. I've been down to his training camp with Emmanuel Stewart, but I'm just tired of seeing him stand there with that stiff arm jab terminally out and throwing jabs all night long. If I had that body and that height, and that muscle tone, the things I would do, forget about it. And this guy wants to fight back it up with a stiff arm fist out there, just throwing jabs all night and keeping everybody away from him. He's afraid to get hit. It's frustrating to watch this fight. So, for Povetkin, I find him to be a little exciting fighter.
Yeah, I guess they're finally going to make the hay fight, too, with one of the Klitschko's there. So,
yeah.
How about that? That should be interesting. Getting back to, before we go, Teddy Atlas, what's it like just knowing that guy and, you know, being associated with him, you know, his history with the sport?
You know, Teddy's a great guy. He's a very intense person. He's extremely loyal. I think he has a very high bar for the people around him, a high standard that he expects them to live up to, and in return he gives you back that same degree of respect and loyalty. He runs a great foundation, a charity foundation, where they provide medical treatment for kids who otherwise wouldn't be able to get medical treatment, wheelchairs for people who are in need, wheelchair ramps. You know, believe it or not, sometimes insurance companies will pay for the treatment, they'll pay for the wheelchair, but they won't pay for the ramp for the person to be able to get out of their house and go see the world. And that's where Teddy Allen will step in, and he'll get a ramp paid for and built and installed. He's redone people's homes, remodeled them, so that they can move around the house in their wheelchair. Most recently, we opened up two youth boxing gyms, and we've got four kids who are fighting in the Pan Am qualifying games. We have one guy who's already qualified for the Olympic trials, and last year in New York City, the gyms won the New York Golden Gloves, the Daily News Golden Glove Tournament, which is a pretty prestigious tournament here. So he's got a staple of young fighters that more than just making them fighters, we're turning them into young, responsible, socially cognizant young men and women. And hopefully they'll go on to, if not in the fight game, they'll go on to contribute to society in some meaningful way. That's the goal. And, I also think as far as commentating, I think he's one of the best ones out there.
Yeah.
I don't know how you guys feel about that, but when he's doing the Friday Night Fight for the ESPN, I mean, his analysis to me is just head and shoulders above most of the people that are out there across the board on all the other networks.
Right, yeah, he does an excellent job there. One question I always try to ask every guest, what do you love most about what you do, you know, whether it's being associated with boxing or just being a lawyer?
That's easy. As being a lawyer, I get to help people and I make a difference in their lives. Very simple. People come to me, they're down and out, something's gone wrong in their life, and I get to step in, not as a social worker, but as a person who, as a litigator, as a trial attorney, who gets the opportunity to right the wrong. And most times, not always, because as you know, sometimes it's tough. You get one side of the story that many times, and you do discovery, and you do an investigation, and you say, I'm on the wrong side of this equation. But most times, I'm on the right side of the equation. I'm fighting what I believe to be a very righteous cause, and it's a very powerful feeling to know that you have somebody's livelihood, somebody's future in your hands, and it's an enormous amount of responsibility that I take very, very seriously. So I tell people The next best thing to being a social worker, without ever having to do that, you know, warm, you feel good, fuzzy interaction of the social work world. So I truly love what I do. I get to teach, the litigators and lawyers of tomorrow, which is real nice for me. And, I'm happy. I have my own firm, and I'm a legal commentator for various media outlets, and I really love what I do. It's a great, great career. Not for everybody, and we take a tough rap, lawyers, and sometimes much deserved, but I truly love what I do.
Yeah, it's a complicated profession, and I've seen it where it's taken me a while, to understand that, sometimes these guys are just doing their jobs, and they have to do it that way. It's not that they're punks or creeps. It's just that they have to represent their client, It's just, they got to do it to the best of their ability, because they don't believe them sometimes.
Absolutely.
But anybody you want to thank or give a shout-out to before we let you go?
Just to you guys and to anybody out there that's listening that wants to come to the BWAA dinner. It's going to be at the MGM in Vegas, first Friday night in May. Same night, there's going to be an ESPN show that Friday night on the Strip, and it's the night before the big Pacquiao fight. And, guys, I appreciate you having me on. Rich, thank you very much. It was great sticking around with you guys. And I'd love to be back on again sometime. Just let me know.
Sure.
Great. Thank you. All right, fellas. Thanks a lot, man. Have a good one.
All right.
Hey,
good luck with you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay.
I think you did a good job.
Yeah, that's great. I thought he was going to be on, legal terms. I only have 20 minutes. My time is valuable. But he went pretty long for, especially in recent weeks when we've only done about an hour show. That was a nice, meaty interview. So that's good stuff. Like I said, we're going to get back to the boxing stuff. The schedule here, I just put it back up in front of me. And we got a fight on Saturday in Argentina. That's pretty interesting for the WBA World Featherweight title. It's going to be Jonathan Victor Barros, 31-1 with 18 knockouts, one draw, fighting Miguel Roman. It's 33-7 with 25 knockouts. Saw that one on there. Box Wreck there, Tony. Jonathan Victor Barros versus Miguel Roman for the WBA World Featherweight title.
Who are you picking?
I like Barros with only one loss, But Miguel Roman has a little bit more experience, a little bit more knockouts. Never been knocked out himself. Well, neither has Barros. Oh, I hate to pick featherweights because, it's usually always a 12-rounder. although these guys have quite a bit of knockouts. We'll see. And Roman lost his last fight, so.
Slightly off the topic, when we were talking, I found a website with a ton of stuff on that Tim Doc Anderson page. I first came on the show with you in January 2008, and it was one of the topics that we first discussed. It was one of the first things I brought to the table, and that was 3 years ago. It looks like this page with a lot of these articles was developed in 2005. But I sent you the link. It has a couple articles. It has a letter to the judge written by one of Tim Anderson's best friends. It also has just, a couple articles that were written about it and just, some of the way that the public defender really screwed up. I mean, there was about six or seven witnesses that he failed to call. He failed to call the physician that diagnosed the guy by being poisoned. But yeah, I sent it to you, and I said, I don't know if you want to maybe post it on my site or anything, but any eyes that can see this, it can't hurt.
Yeah.
And also, the one guy that got up and told me, I'm going to email him and try to get him on for an interview.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do a lot of good things like that.
That would be a great story to go back to. That's kind of interesting, you know, the whole network of politics out here in Vegas, and, you know, this the mob elements that are still around, and, you know, the different characters that influence the political side of things with their campaign finances. In the last couple of days, I've just been kind of, you know, circling the wagons against the Fertittas and, you know, trying to figure out some different avenues to expose what they've done out here. And I just got into the story of a guy out here named Rick Rizzolo, who they did some prison time. He had a strip club out here, and actually he had a strip club with part ownership with Mike Piazza's father out in Philadelphia, of all places.
Yeah.
And he sold it for $1 million and didn't tell the government about it when he owed a victim of a savage beating that left the guy paralyzed outside the club. And that was one of this guy's agents working for him who did it. And it was over an $88 bar tab, and the guy won a legal judgment against this mobbed up guy for over $11 million. And, you know, this family, the husband and wife, are still trying to get their money out of this guy. And the only thing he's had to agree to is $1,000 a month payments. And I think his insurance paid like $1 million right off the bat. But it's just like, I start getting off on these tangents and looking at these different cases, and I just say to myself, geez, there's just so much injustice out there, you know? And it's just, I wish at some point, even if I don't become a real lawyer, you know, I would have an opportunity to either write about this kind of stuff or talk about it and put more exposure on it, because it's just, that's the one thing that people don't realize, you know, it's half of it is just the attention that something gets, you know, because in my case, I would have never got this far against billionaire people, the Fertittas out here, if I didn't have the publication side of things. You know, because you really have to put the spotlight on it, because that makes judges say, wait a second, you know, do I really want to go down in history as the judge who, you know, wouldn't give this kid what he deserved? You know, and this is the internet, so it's kind of even more damaging in some respects than a newspaper, because even newspapers, you know, 3 years later, the article might be gone off their website even. But on the internet, you know, as long as you're paying your hosting fees, you can keep something on there as long as you live. So that case that you mentioned and brought up again, you know, it's just another example of, you know, justice moving slowly in reverse. You know?
Yeah.
But those are the kind of cases I love, you know, because I love to get involved in something where somebody tells me, or everybody believes in the beginning, that there's no way I can even get anywhere with it. You know, it's like the underdog syndrome, I guess. I like being the underdog because, it number one, it makes people think, well, you know, there's nothing to worry about with this guy. You know, he's his own lawyer, no big deal. But there's so many different ways you can use it to your advantage. But in that case down there in Florida, you know, there's a guy behind bars, and there's actually a movie I just watched not too long ago called Conviction, about a Massachusetts woman who put herself through law school to get her brother out of jail for a murder he didn't commit at all. You know, and decades.
What was this, a real story, a true story?
True story, yeah. Called Conviction.
Do you remember the woman's name?
The woman's name?
Yeah.
Geez, off the top of my head, I can't remember it, but she was...
I remember hearing about that. That's why I was wondering if you happen to remember, because I would you know, be able to give some insight on it. Because I do remember that. I do remember reading the story that a woman took herself to help fight his conviction.
I know her first two names were Patty Ann. I think it was Patty Ann Smith, even though that sounds pretty generic. But
yeah, I'm trying to remember.
But the movie's Conviction. I'm going to look it up right now just so I get the name right. And Hilary Swank is the one who played her. And it was a good movie. I mean, it's just it just goes to show you how hard you have to work to overcome a bad decision in court, you know, and how powerful judges and DAs and the whole political system behind the courts can be. And being out here in Vegas, you know, because of my court situation, I just had a meeting with the lawyers for the first time, the Fertitta lawyers, in their big ninth floor offices at the top of this big tower office building out here in Vegas. And it was a moment that most people probably would have been a little bit intimidated by. And, you know, I went in there just being completely calm, and they had two big lawyers in there across the table from me, and I'm there by myself. And, you know, I just got the feeling, you know, look at these guys. They're bringing out their big guns. They probably each combined probably making over $1,000 just for this couple hours worth of time that they're, you know, trying to work things out with me. And then nothing got worked out, you know, because they were just sitting there trying to give me all these demands. And I just, it's like, whatever. I'm not bothered. And I just could look, and I looked at the main lawyer's face when I left. And he literally just let out this big sigh in the lobby. And it was just like, those little things, you know, they mean more to me than judgment sometimes, because it's like, that's what I do it for, because that guy just obviously learned some kind of lesson that, you know, you can't underestimate somebody just because they represent themselves. And you know, just because you're doing your job doesn't mean you can't be on the wrong side of the law. But that's my soapbox.
I did mention tonight about an article that, you know, I think we should get. Obviously, it's not finished yet. A week or so ago, I got an email from a girl in the Harleysville area, whose family I know. She's working on a high school project, and decided that they wanted to write it somehow about, you know, movies that are being that have been done in Philadelphia as it's becoming more popular now. And then, of course, how the art museum steps have become so widely popular due to the Rocky movie. Of course, since I've known the family for the first 6-7 years, they remember my escapades from a couple of years ago. And they decided to interview me. Girl found me on Facebook and sent me a message. I said, absolutely. And, you know, they came over the other night just as I was finishing my workout. And the first thing I said, you said, you got to understand something. I said, I am probably, when it comes to interviews, probably one of the most, you know, work with kind of guys, because I know what it's like to be on the other side of the fence in the journalism forte. So, I'm always happy to help somebody, you know, especially in that, especially somebody younger that's, you know, trying to do a school project and, you know, get their feet wet in the business. So they came over, her and the girl she's writing the article with, and, you know, they went over a lot of questions. And, of course, I mean, not only am I talking about boxing and movies, I mean, I'm talking about history. Why do you think Rocky is the popular movie that stands up to this day? Why? Because it's in Philadelphia. I mean, need I say more? I mean, you know, but I said, no, I said, I mean, you look at it. Rocky's an underdog story. People love underdog stories. You know, I said, man, right now, America is probably the most powerful country in the world. You know, it's a rich nation. It's a nation that's high in technology. It's a world leader. But America still kind of remembers its roots. You know, 1776 and George Washington, and, you know, nobody expected, you know, the United States to, you know, be able to beat the British. You know, it was never going to happen, and, you know, that's where the underdog mentality came from, and you won. And, you know, and everybody felt great about themselves. So I started, you know, talking about George Washington and all that. It was a good interview, and then the girl's like, why do you think, you know, a lot of you know, Hollywood people now want to, you know, set some of their movies in Philadelphia. I said, because we've got good cheesesteaks. Need I say more? But it was a good interview. We had a lot of laughs. She said, she has an email me today that she just finished writing it. She's submitting it for her class, and she's going to request permission from her teacher if we can post it on the website here.
All right. Yeah, sure. That woman's name is Betty Ann Waters. I totally butchered it. I got the middle name right. That was it. She got her brother out. He was convicted in 1983, and he was exonerated on June 19th, 2001. So it just goes to show you how long it takes. And it's just like, you know, that movie is just one of those examples of sometimes, you know, the justice system isn't enough. You know, sometimes it's the product of the creative product that gets out to the masses that does more. The movie only made about almost $7 million. Its budget was $12 million, so they made a big deal out of it, and it definitely it served its purpose. I mean, I watched it and was really inspired. It just came out last year, actually, 2010. And I know that my lawyer friend we just got off the phone with would probably not approve, but I did watch it for free. But I'll send you a link to it. And I won't tell everybody, just so I don't get sued myself. But anyway, we do have a little bit of MMA to get back to. Fight's coming up this weekend. We got a fight in Abu Dhabi tomorrow night, ADFC round 3. We have a fight called Jewels in Tokyo tomorrow night. Shark fights 14 in tomorrow night from on tomorrow night from or tomorrow, I should say, in Lubbock, Texas. Shark fights 14. Big deal, I guess. We also have Wild Bill's fight night in Duluth, Georgia. Clash of the Titans 9 in Greeley, Colorado, all tomorrow. On Saturday, we have Total Combat 39 from Durham, England. Cage Contender 8 from Dublin, Ireland. Shooter's Legacy 2 in Tokyo, Japan. And I haven't gone through it yet, but there's an article on SureDog all about some controversy dealing with the Shooter organization. So check that out if you get a chance. We also have a Montreal Fight League event in Montreal on Saturday. Battlefield Fight League 6 from Vancouver. Let's see what else we got. Eclipse Genesis Fights from Shoreline, Washington. And, of course, the biggest one. Actually, I think they're the third largest organization behind Strikeforce now, I read today. Bellator Fighting Championships 36 is going on in Shreveport, Louisiana on Saturday. We have Floripa Fight 7 in Brazil Saturday. Champions 3, the X1 organization in Honolulu, Hawaii. Fight Festival 30 in Helsinki, Finland. We have Frank Lee's Combat League in Edmonton, Alberta. Night of the Gladiators 7 in Staffordshire, England. Ultimate Rage 1 in South Yorkshire, England. Back into the Cage in Andover, England. Cage Fighters Championship 9 in Brentwood, Essex, England. And bear with me, we got a few more here. We got one more in Japan, Tribal 8, Volume 32 on Saturday. And then we got Beatdown at Four Bears 8 at the Four Bears Casino and Lodge in Newtown, North Dakota. And I don't think that involves actual bears. So if you're looking for that, wrong place. Future Stars of MMA is going on Saturday. That's the last event for Saturday on here. Las Vegas, the Orleans Hotel and Casino, Saturday. Tough enough. Another fight I probably won't be able to go to because I'll be working on the battlethebadges.info site. Going to get that nipped in the mud this weekend. We also have Heat 17 from Aichi, Japan on Sunday. Impressive Tour 2, Pancrase Organization in Osaka. Also Sunday, and then finally 10th Legion, Invasion of Warriors from Scala, London. And then, of course, the big UFC 128 is coming up next weekend, Shogun versus Jones. I'm just going to go through that lineup real quick. We have Uriah Faber versus Eddie Wineland, Joseph Benavidez versus Ian Loveland, Mirko Velopovic, better known as Crow Cop, fighting Brendan Schaub, which would be a good fight, former Ultimate Fighter guy there. Jim Miller fighting Kamal Shalarouf, who actually we just had on the show a few weeks ago, months maybe now. That's Nate Marquardt versus Yoshihiro Akiyama is also on that card. Rafael Asensio versus Eric Koch. Ricardo Almeida versus Mike Pyle. Kurt Pellegrino versus Gleison Tebow. Anthony Nokuani versus Edson Barboza Jr. Dan Miller versus Nick Catone. And Louis Arthur Kane Jr. versus Elliot Marshall. And these are all undercard fights of Mauricio Hua, the number one light heavyweight, and John Jones, the big Zion-sponsored guy there. He's on this card. And actually, the other day there was this big video circulating online of John Jones' professional debut. And just so happens that it was for an organization that I used to cover in Massachusetts all the time. And it was a little bit further from my jurisdiction, I guess you'd say, than I normally traveled. But I did find out after the fact when I watched it, and I realized that, you know, he came up through Massachusetts-based fighting groups, that I found out there was a fight of his. I think it was his fourth or fifth fight at, I'll tell you right now, at Foxwoods Casino that I did go to. And it was a fight, War in the Woods 3 was the event. It was back in May of 2008, and it was the night that I interviewed Gabriel Gonzaga. It was probably one of the worst quality interviews I've ever done because of the tape. That it was on a tape recorder, then I digitized it after the fact. But it was a great interview. I mean, he had a lot to say. And actually, I didn't even believe it was him. Somebody told me, hey, you know, that's Gabriel Gonzaga over there. And I said, yeah, whatever. You know, and I actually went over to the guy and I go, are you Gabriel Gonzaga? Kind of funny. But yeah, he did an interview with me after the fact. And that was one of John Jones's first fights. It was his fourth fight overall, and he beat Ryan Verrett in the first round, 3 minutes, just about 3 minutes in. And you know, I don't remember it off the top of my head, but you know, it was a pretty big day for me. We it was our, you know, early beginnings in covering fights. We didn't really go to too many back then, but we did go to whatever was close. And you know, that was one of the biggest venues I'd ever been to a fight at. And actually the first MMA fight I ever bet on, because it was one of the guys that I went with, knew the kid. I bet on him and lost. But our other friend who was on the card actually won his fight. And it was a pretty interesting night. I got actually pretty smashed. I snuck in some grape wine, and I was drinking like a fish that night. I just remember I kept screaming, hit him in the face! That was a great night. And now John Jones is, of course, in the UFC. He made it to the UFC three fights later with UFC 87. He's only lost once to Matt Hamill. It was illegal downward elbows, so it was kind of like a Fedor situation. His only loss was like a cut or something. It opened up, and up until he started getting beaten, Strikeforce, at least, he was almost considered undefeated by most people. And you could say the same thing about Jones. He's virtually undefeated. So this fight's going to be very big. I expect him to win, just because his style, I think, is way better than Hua's. The only trouble he's going to have is with the BJJ, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu there. But otherwise, he should be okay, I think. It's definitely going to be a fight that is going to prove his worth, I think. And he comes out of the Jackson camp, which is very well known. And word is that the original opponent for Hua, Rashad Evans there, he's out with a knee injury right now, so that's why John Jones got this fight. And they have said that they will fight. fight each other, even though I think they train at the same place. They will definitely fight each other. They're going to put that aside, whereas usually the people from the refuse to fight each other, and it's been a bone of contention that's really pissed Dana White off. But that's the way it is. You know, these guys, they have a tight training camp. What can you do? Other than that, I don't know. You got anything else you want to talk about?
No, man. I covered pretty much everything I wanted to talk about tonight. a lot of good things. Man, you know what, Rich, to be honest, I am glad we had a good show tonight. I had, first of all, it's pouring down here, and I had such a, down here, I should say out here, because you're out west in Vegas, where it's probably 138 degrees. And it's such a shitty day. People are pissing me off. And, you know, people, they run their mouth. And, you know, you want to tell me, you know, just do me a favor and shut the fuck up. But you can't do that all the time, because apparently that's not nice. And it was like, I was just aggravated. I haven't had a good workout in about 2 days. The weather's been bad, so it's like, you know, just something tonight to get the mind off everything, have a good talk. You know what? And, you know, 8 more hours of, you know, sitting and dealing with bullshit, I'm going to have 2 days off, and I'm going to get to go to a hockey game, and I'm going to get to not be at work. And that's going to be a lot of fun, because, you know, people just piss me off. I don't like being pissed off. It's better than being pissed on, I understand that, but I don't like either one of them.
Well, that's a unique way of putting it. But,
yeah, I try.
As far as the weather out here, it's kind of weird. You know, it's I hate to say it, but I'm almost turning into one of those people that, you know, when the temperature goes down to 65 or 70, I feel like I need to wear a jacket. But it's just weird looking around here at some of the wildlife, you know, the trees especially, because it's considered winter out here, even though it's 70 most days, and the trees have lost their leaves, you know, and the leaves don't come back, I guess, until it's 80 or 90 every day. I don't know how that works. It just seems weird to me. But that's Vegas, and you can see the mountains all around us, of course, and all the mountaintops, well, the biggest ones in the distance anyway, have snow on them still. So it's a little bit of a reminder of winter, but I actually called back to the house there where I used to live, I guess you could say. I don't know. It's kind of tough being out here, but I called back to the house, and my buddy's up there on the roof shoveling snow off of his roof, and he says, yeah, there's still 4 feet of snow on the ground out here. You know, I need you to come back. But I actually do kind of miss it. You know, it just seems very weird to have it always the same temperature or always warm. It never seems that cold. Well, that's Vegas. I got to start taking advantage of it and get some runs in myself. Just been, you know, throwing up one excuse after another not to do it. But I actually just had to cancel my fight, too. My big fight on the that I thought was going to be on the Battle of the Badges card. Turned out, Dennis, he says he told me this, but I specifically remember, like, the whole promoter of this card saying, oh, I heard you're going to fight on this card. And Dennis had set me up with this fight with this guy. He told me the guy's name and everything. And then 2 weeks ago, he tells me, oh, yeah, it's going to be on April 16th in your hometown there in Dorchester at the Armory. And I'm like, what? You know, why would I want to do that, you know? If I'm out here until the Battle of the Badges, you know, I don't want to end up having to come back on the 16th and come all the way back out here and then come back for the 30th, you know, because the Battle of the Badges is on the 30th. And he's like, oh, well, I told you 6 times. And it's like, yes. You know, if I had a more certain plan for, you know, what was going on, maybe I would have done it anyway. But no way. If it's not on the Battle of the Badges, I just wouldn't want to do it. You know, even though it is in my hometown, and I would have liked to try, maybe another time. But it's just kind of a funny aspect of being out of here. I have to give that up. But other than that, check the blog out. We've actually there to make it a little better. I just figured out the other day how to make it easy enough for me to get back to the regular MMA, boxing, and wrestling links that I used to do every day. Through my Google Alerts, I just cut and paste them now, and it's going to be, there's going to be way more links in the stories, there's going to be way more pictures, and we're going to go back to a more visual style on the blog. And as soon as I get up and running with the web design program, we're going to have another Ring Girl competition up there. So look at that.
You can never say no to that.
No, we can't. And being out here in Vegas, I mean, it's gonna be, if I stick it out here, I'm definitely going to have to do some kind of live event along those lines. I'm sure a lot of places would love to have that competition. bring the people in. But until next week, I think that's all I have. We thank Keith Sullivan for being a great guest, and like you said, he wants to be on later again, and we'll try to make that happen before the year is out. We'll think of another reason to bring him back, I'm sure. And definitely, we will keep in touch with him. And hope that he gets a case that, you know, or he gets more cases to be involved in boxing and help out boxers, because it seems like he definitely is very knowledgeable of the sport and big fan and knows all the right people. And we'll have to look into getting me into the Boxing Writers Association, too. Have you tried to get into that?
No, I haven't, but that'd be pretty cool.
Yeah, we ought to be able to get in. I mean, we have plenty of stories out there.
That sounds pretty awesome. I'd love to get into that.
And maybe you come out to Vegas.
you never know. It should be the first step in getting me out of the hellhole that I'm in.
Yeah, who knows? Sounds like it's like a boxing union, a boxing writers union almost. Could be cool.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind doing that at all, man.
All right, well, thanks for stopping by, folks, as always. And until next week, adios. Signing off.
This is your boy the Tornado, and I am out.